You're listening to On Shifting Ground. I'm Ray Suarez. The International Criminal Court's condemnation of President Putin has shed light on the mass deportation of thousands of Ukrainian children. But these abductions have been happening since the very beginning of the invasion.
Part of the plan from the beginning was to empty out parts of Ukraine of those individuals who would be supportive of Ukrainian independence and autonomy and replace those individuals with sort of lackeys who will help enable an occupation of the territory. And an element of these vast filtration operations is the role of children as well being taken out. So these filtration operations are a massive attempt to change the demography of the area and to be able to assert control over Ukrainian territory. And as President Biden said, you know, by Russia stealing Ukraine's children, they're essentially stealing Ukraine's future.
That's Beth Von Schack, Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice at the State Department. Earlier this year, Secretary of State Antony Blinken determined that members of Russia's armed forces and other officials have committed crimes against humanity. That designation follows extensive analysis by the State Department, including the Office of Global Criminal Justice. For Ambassador Von Schack, it was clear the U.S. needed to act in accordance with the ICC to help stop Russian crimes against humanity. But it's useful to remember that on a wide variety of issues, the vast, sprawling, complicated U.S. government doesn't always speak with one voice. In the case of the war in Ukraine and what's happening in greater Eastern Europe, there are a lot of perspectives on what to do next. And where we go from here is anyone's guess. A few days before the ICC issued an arrest warrant for Putin, Ambassador Von Schack joined me to discuss where the invasion stands today and how the United States can see that Russia is prosecuted for war crimes. That is, if the U.S. can see to it that Russia is prosecuted. Ambassador, welcome to On Shifting Ground.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's been a couple of weeks since the first anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. How did your office respond to it?
Indeed, it has been 1 year now since Russia relaunched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and it's been a year of horrific stories of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and other atrocities coming out of Ukraine. My office has been very focused on helping to document and to capacitate others to document these abuses with an eye towards laying the groundwork for future accountability. And we're supporting a whole range of accountability pathways that are possible as this war unfolds.
Well, last March, the International Criminal Court fast-tracked an investigation of war crimes by Russia in Ukraine. While you wait to see what they've determined in their investigations, what does your office, the State Department, the Biden administration at large, believe that Russia has done during this latest chapter in its invasion of Ukraine?
Well, very soon after I took this position, I had to announce the United States' determination that Russia's forces were committing war crimes in virtually every area in which they were deployed. This was everything from either deliberately targeting civilian infrastructure or using disproportionate force and indiscriminate attacks around civilian infrastructure. It also involved harm to individuals in custody, both civilians but also potential prisoners of war, individuals who were combatants who were being mistreated when they were held within Russia's control. And this is only in areas that we have access to where we can have investigators or journalists or advocates. We know that as additional areas become liberated, more and more of this evidence is going to come to light. Now, very recently, Vice President Kamala Harris announced at the Munich Security Conference that we've also determined that not only Russia's military forces, but also some of their political figures have committed crimes against humanity. This involves a widespread or a systematic attack against the civilian population. And so it's a different way of characterizing what's happening. But what it suggests is that these acts are not the result of rogue units acting on their own, but rather part of a pattern and practice that is seen across the country and that is pursuant to some sort of a policy emerging from the Kremlin.
Well, we are talking about Russia here, permanent member of the UN Security Council, a continent-straddling nuclear-armed state. It's not Liberia. It's not Yugoslavia. It's not Rwanda or Cambodia. Are there mechanisms to investigate, indict, try, and punish places like Russia? And if you try, can Putin and the people who keep him in power just ignore it?
It's a great question. There are three active now pathways to justice. One is the investigations going forward in Ukrainian national system. Their courts are open and operating, even under incredibly challenging conditions. Investigators are having to duck into bunkers after air raid sirens go off while they're conducting their work in the field or in Kyiv in the headquarters. There's also, as you mentioned, the International Criminal Court. But the Europeans have also banded together to create a joint investigative team. They're sharing information about potential cases that might be brought in European courts. And the United States has a new law, thanks to Congress, that will enable the United States to be able to potentially prosecute war crimes in United States courts if the perpetrator is ultimately found here. Now, many of these efforts going forward require the presence of an accused in custody. So Ukraine has some Russian soldiers in their custody, and those cases are moving forward for violence against civilians, for sexual violence, for attacks on elements of the civilian infrastructure, even for acts of the invasion, etc. Those are in train within the Ukrainian courts. But it's because they have those individuals in custody or because Ukrainian law allows for in absentia proceedings. The ICC cannot operate. It can only get so far without custody of the accused. So long as senior leadership remain within Russia, they will enjoy impunity. But we also know that this war will eventually come to an end and people will want to travel. They may need to leave if there's a political transformation of some sort. And so that will make them fair game. And the world's prosecutors are standing ready. There are case files open. There are investigations happening. There is documentation being preserved, all with an eye towards holding those responsible once they do fall into custody of a prosecutor with jurisdiction.
Now, granted, right now, Russians can travel, not necessarily to the garden spots of the world, but they can go to Iran and Syria and Kazakhstan and China, a variety of places, because a lot of the world community is not necessarily on board with taking a punitive attitude toward Russia, almost no matter what it does in Ukraine. When you talk about the difficulty with traveling, the difficulty with accessing resources and assets held outside the country, do we end up with kind of with a bifurcated world, a patchwork quilt map of places that aren't necessarily very anxious to move against Vladimir Putin or his cronies?
Indeed. You know, Russia is a permanent member of the Security Council, so will, of course, be able to veto any coercive measures that might be attempted there. So it has not been possible to impose global sanctions, travel bans, freezing of assets, etc. But I will say the world is increasingly united around the imperative of foreclosing the ability of Russians to travel and to have assets and resources available for them to continue to prosecute this terrible war. And so a lot of those assets around the globe have been frozen, not only sovereign assets, but also oligarch assets of close allies of the Kremlin. And so it's going to be harder and harder for those individuals to get access to those resources in order to be able to continue to operate. But as you said, there are some parts of the world that don't feel they're bound by those sanctions. And so they will potentially be able to continue to welcome those individuals to travel. But we have to remember that those individuals may have to travel over airspace, right, that is controlled by ICC state members. And so they can disallow those flight plans. And so you have to look carefully at a map to figure out how individuals might travel from point A to point B. But there's lots of ways that the world has been able to close off Russia and make it much more difficult for them to operate as a member of the global community.
But that would require, I think it's fair to say, an escalation of the kind of measures that members of the world community would be ready to take, forcing down a jet, taking someone into custody on foreign soil. I mean, are a lot of countries ready to be that tough on a country that still cuts such a big swath in the world?
Well, it remains to be seen. But remember that the last big vote at the General Assembly, there were 141 states that voted to condemn Russia's acts of aggression and to call for comprehensive accountability. So there is a recognition that Russia has really breached some of the principles that we hold dear as an international community, completely undermining a rules-based international order, not just violations of the right to sovereignty or territorial integrity or political independence, which, of course, inspired the UN Charter in the first place after World War II, but also the right of ordinary people to live a peaceful and dignified life, to plan their own life path. And I think many of the international community are really disgusted by what Russia has done, not only within Ukraine, but there are these vast reverberations around the globe in terms of increased food insecurity, supply chains that are disrupted, you know, the chaos that is wrought by having a major armed conflict within Europe. And so many states are feeling the harm of this war and so are increasingly banded together to recognize that this has to come to an end. And the one party that has the ability to bring it to an end is President Putin himself.
Now, according to the New York Times, the Department of Defense is reluctant to let the Biden administration share evidence that it has with the International Criminal Court in The Hague that's gathered by American intelligence resources because U.S. military officials believe it could set a precedent that could end up with Americans in the dock in various places around the world. This is an internal debate inside the administration. I don't have Lloyd Austin here, no surprise, but I do have you. What's your side of the argument so people can understand what points your agency would make in that debate about the possible exposure, the possible vulnerability of Americans around the globe if the U.S. shares what it knows about Russia's efforts in Ukraine with the ICC?
Well, the United States is not a member of the ICC statute, so we're not under any sort of cooperation obligations legally. But in the past, we have looked for ways to assist the work of the court. That includes everything from information sharing to diplomatic support to helping to bring fugitives to The Hague when they've landed in our custody in various ways, including one who showed up at the Kigali embassy in Rwanda asking to be transferred to The Hague. So there's lots of ways that we can be of assistance, even as a non-party. And we recognize that the ICC plays an important role within a larger ecosystem of international justice. And this set of prosecutions, we'll wait to see what charges are brought and against whom, but they're likely to be extremely consequential. And Ukraine cares deeply about working in partnership with the International Criminal Court. And there's nothing that the United States forces would ever do that would come anywhere near being the equivalent of what Russia has entailed here in terms of a full-scale war of aggression, World War II style, seeking territorial acquisition to essentially eliminate the concept of Ukraine on the planet. Putin doesn't see Ukraine as an actual viable political entity, but rather should be a vassal state of Russia. There's nothing a lot, and the level and the amount of atrocities that we're seeing, there's just no comparison to what the United States might engage in if it were, again, involved in some sort of armed conflict somewhere. And so I would hope that this vast disparity in terms of the distinction between some allegations that have been brought against U.S. personnel in Afghanistan or Iraq are nothing compared to what we're seeing in the Russian context. And so I think the United States should be a part of the justice solution, and that would include assisting with these investigations. But this is a discussion that ultimately will be made by the U.S. government as a whole, and so we'll wait to see how those negotiations ensue.
You mentioned that the United States is not and never has been part of the ICC. Aren't the Pentagon's arguments in this regard very similar to the ones that are given as an explanation for why we're not in the International Criminal Court?
Indeed, we have always in the past, it's been difficult for the United States to submit itself to supranational jurisdiction. So we're not a member of the Inter-American Court, for example, even though many other states in our hemisphere are a member. That's a sovereign choice, and we respect the sovereign choice of other states to join international institutions if it's within their interest to do so. But as I said, I think there's still much that the United States can do, even as a non-party state. And I would rather us be a non-party state that's helpful than a state that is a party that's ultimately not helpful. And there are plenty of states in the world that have not necessarily been able to be in a position to be of assistance to the ICC in a way that we might be able to be.
One thing that Russia does regularly in the world arena is mirror activities, which are not necessarily validly the same, but they allege that they're the same. And in this context, when Ukraine started trying people that it picked up on the battlefield and accused them of war crimes and began to try them, Russia started to try Ukrainian prisoners and try to convict them of war crimes. Every time an accusation is lodged against Russia for its activities in this regard, it simply turns the argument around and says, well, this is what country X has done in this case, and this is what the United States has done in this case. And that's an argument that's actually heard in a lot of places in the world. It may be scoffed at in Washington, but it is given the time of day in South Africa, in Saudi Arabia, in China.
There's no question that Russia is quite adept at manipulating information, disinformation, misinformation, and propaganda in order to try and deflect attention away from who is the ultimate bad actor in this situation. So there's a lot of this kind of whataboutism. And I think the key is always to point back to the actual facts that have been gathered by credible sources. You don't have to look at the facts that we've developed. You look at what Human Rights Watch have said, what the Independent Conflict Observatory at Yale University has said, what journalists and advocates, what the Nobel Peace Prize winner, the Center for Civil Liberties in Ukraine has gathered. And all of this information points in the same direction. That's the way, I think, to counter the kind of mis and disinformation that Russia would try and peddle in order to create a sort of a revisionist account of what's happened here. The bad actor here is Russia. Russia initiated this war. Russia's in the position to be able to end this war. And there's a hope that some sort of a negotiated solution could be created. But so far, Russia has shown no interest at all in communicating and talking about these situations, but rather continues to respond by directly attacking other areas around Ukraine and putting the civilian population at harm. So that's the answer, is look to the facts that have been gathered by reputable sources, and you'll see that their whataboutism is nothing but hot air.
But I'm wondering if we have to think about these questions differently in the digital age, because there's been a kind of, I don't know, technological arms race, an informational arms race. In the 13-month-old war, Russia's not only denied its own role in atrocities, but it's accused Ukrainian forces of the same thing, complete with videotape confessions and still camera evidence of dead soldiers and dead civilians. They've basically said with a straight face, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, Putin himself, the defense minister, Shoigu, that here's Russian evidence of Ukraine killing its own people in order to pin it on us. Here are videotape confessions from soldiers from the front who we have picked up in the heat of battle. This is circulating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on the internet. You can see it cited in chat rooms and endlessly picked up and copied and passed on to other people. It's a new kind of information war. I mean, the old saying is that the truth is the first casualty on the battlefield, but is it fair to say that the 21st century has brought new weapons into the fray?
There's no question that this will now be one of the biggest documented crime bases in human history, and so much of that is digital evidence. And we know, too, how easy it is to manipulate digital evidence and to create deep fakes. But we also have counter tools that are able to identify when something has been falsified, for example, looking at everything from geolocation to the manipulation of metadata to the direction of shadows to be able to identify what time something was taken, et cetera. So unfortunately, it's painstaking work and it takes time, but it is possible to debunk some of these false and fake digital artifacts that Russia is peddling out there to try and support its version of history. It is true that this is a new realm. We have the land war, we have sea wars, air wars, and we have the information war.
The horrifying and scary thing about it is that when you try to nail it down, you're dealing with a state that, what, you're just going to ask them straight up, how many people do you have and where you have them? That you have a foreign minister who goes on the world stage and tells amazing, fanciful tales about the original causes of the war and how it started and what they're trying to achieve. Russia's not going to tell you where these people are. Russia's not going to tell you how many it took. Russia's not going to tell you how many have died in custody. It's a horrifying situation.
What's interesting, though, is given the penetration of smartphones and the social media platforms, it's actually possible to find a lot of this data and information by virtue of being able to scrub social media sites. Perpetrators are chatting with each other in chat sites. They're posting trophy videos on their Facebook pages. Individuals are talking to each other about policy and what they're how they're imposing and enforcing those policies. And so all of this can be captured by some of these open source investigators who are out there constantly scrubbing these social media sites, these chat rooms, and preserving that information so that when it's discovered and they shut those chat rooms down, there's a digital record that's taken. We're also able to give each one of those records a unique fingerprint. It's called a hash. And that enables us to prove that it hasn't been touched since it was created. And all of this can be kept and preserved in evidentiary vaults that then can be used and invoked when the time comes, when a prosecutor is ready to look at the underlying facts. And so it's always a race, of course, and the perpetrators are always several steps ahead. But there are so many individuals, groups, governments documenting these events, and so many digital artifacts that are left behind, the detritus of people just talking to friends and family, that we are able to piece things together even without accurate information from Russia itself.
I'd like to close with you by talking a little bit about what's conceivable. Vladimir Putin is one of the world's richest men. He's one of the world's most powerful men. He's not Thomas Sankara or Bashar in Sudan or the head of the Interahamwe among the Hutus in Rwanda. He's not somebody who's going to be easy to go after or easy to prosecute. What's the conceivable outcome of this effort? What is not only right by the letter of the law, but also conceivable given the realities of the operation of nations and Russia's place in the world?
Well, what we can do now is we can document, preserve, analyze, and prepare dossiers on particular individuals with respect to particular incidents or patterns of violations. We can also build structures, institutions that are able to exercise jurisdiction over those individuals. And then we wait. We wait until they come into custody, whether it's because of a political transformation within Russia or because somebody wants to travel to Paris for a long weekend or somebody's kid is in school somewhere and they want to visit. And then the prosecutors are ready. And as information emerges that people are traveling, they will be in touch with each other through joint investigative teams and other mechanisms of coordination. And they will be able to move quickly once that happens because all of this prep work, all of this documentation and preparation work will have been done in advance. This is, in a way, building an airplane while we're flying in it of this effort to prepare for accountability while the war is still ongoing. But it's being done, and the world is increasingly united around it. And so the resources are there, and it's just a matter of those serendipitous moments when individual defendants will eventually make a critical error in terms of their travel schedule, and they'll be brought into custody, and those cases can move forward. But all of us in this work know that we're playing a very long game. Slobodan Milosevic, Augusto Pinochet, Hissène Habré of Chad, none of them thought they would ever see the inside of a courtroom, and all of them did eventually. And so that's the time frame that we're operating with.
Beth von Schack is the Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice. Thanks for joining us on Shifting Ground.
Thank you. Thank you so much for covering these important issues.
You've been listening to On Shifting Ground, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from listeners like you. Today's episode was produced by Matteo Schimpf and Andrew Stelzer. Additional production help was provided by our associate producer, Sienna Barnes. It was mixed and mastered by Matteo Schimpf. Our executive producer is Jared Sport. Additional production and engineering were provided by Rob Spate. KQED's Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.